Well, Matthew's gospel is about Jesus, of course. And he began, leaving aside the prologue for the moment, the overture, he began with the list of Jesus' genealogy. He really belongs to us. His grandparents and his great-grandparents, and what Matthew wants when he puts that is to make sure we know we're dealing with one of us, this whole beautiful story. But this one is the one who's fulfilling the covenant to Abraham, and he's the Messiah. So he's David's descendant. The first thing we see of Jesus, very quickly, but it's so beautiful, is the baptism scene. Because Matthew, like Mark and the others, wants us to see what was special about this extraordinary human being, Jesus of Nazareth. And the baptism showed us his intimate communion with God, which is what we all want and which is meant for everybody in the world, of course. And we saw that. And to reinforce that he really belongs to us, we had the scenes in the desert of Jesus' so-called temptations, struggling, like us, to make meaning of life and so on. The first thing Jesus does is to gather disciples. And we saw that. And then the Greek author here, we'll call him Matthew for the moment, he gathers together a lot of sayings about discipleship, and we looked at that in three whole chapters of it, of what it means to say yes to following Jesus. And then we saw Jesus in action. We saw his mission, healing, love, and what it can do where faith welcomes it. And then we see Jesus sharing his mission now with us, and that's what we move on to today. And our author gathers together, not as many, but a number of sayings that would come down through the tradition that Jesus had said about what will happen when you carry on my mission, when you carry on my work. And that's what we're going to look at now. We've heard Jesus' words spoken, as we're told, with authority, not like the scribes. We've been watching Jesus' deeds of power, as long as we understand power properly, the power of love in the life of this Jesus. Matthew's now ready to present Jesus' challenge to his disciples to realize that they too, we too, have power and authority. He's going to share his power with us. That's what it means to be a Christian. It means not to compare ourselves to Jesus or to be like him. There's nothing wrong with being like him, please God. But it's not about that. It's about letting him live in us. As Paul said, I no longer live the ego that I remember. I live, Christ is living in me. So we too, the disciples, and we'll see that, have the authority of Jesus and the power of Jesus. And so we begin with Matthew 9, 36. When Jesus saw the crowds, he had compassion for them. It's a beautiful word in English and it's a beautiful word in Greek. I've got it there for you. It actually comes right from the word for our guts, really, the splanchna. So it's compassion, not just like a pity that we have in our head, oh, the poor people. This is something that's felt in the body, really grips us, and it's painful. And that's the kind of compassion that Jesus had. It rendered his whole being so that it burst forth from him. So he had compassion for them. Why? Because they were harassed and helpless, like sheep without a shepherd. That phrase that Matthew is remembering from Jesus, this comes from the book of Numbers, chapter 27, which reads, "Let the Lord appoint someone over the congregation, the gathering, the assembly, who will go out before them and come in before them, lead them out and lead them home. He shall lead them out and bring them in, so that the congregation of the Lord may not be like sheep without a shepherd." Importance, the need for leadership. Well, the people didn't have it. So he said to his disciples, "Look, the harvest is plentiful." Just look around, he says. The harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few. Therefore, ask. He's just said yesterday, we read it. Ask and you will receive. Ask the Lord of the harvest to send laborers into his harvest. Does that mean that God is waiting for us to do something first? No, surely not. God is constantly loving, constantly raising up leaders. But if we ask, that means we're open. That's what the prayer of petition is about. It's we're facing God and we're open to what God is doing. And I don't want to be critical of myself or of you or of anyone really, but often we ask and we're not looking. We're asking today for leadership in the church. Well, God forsake us, go to any parish. It's everywhere, it's all there. But are we recognising it? Are we open to it? Are we ready to allow it? Or whatever the word is. That's the problem. So he wants us to really ask. But ask meaning open yourself to what God is doing. The signs of the times. So Jesus called 12, that's critical, 12 disciples. And he gave them authority over the unclean spirits to cast them out and to heal every sickness and every weakness. Exactly what we've seen in the last two chapters of the Gospel, Jesus doing. Now he's gathering 12. Why 12? It's obvious, but I'll stress it for a minute. It's to do with the constellations. The sun goes through, according to the ancient Eastern cosmology, goes through 12 constellations in a year's journey. You can find it in the Daily Telegraph, probably, the names if you want them. So it goes through these 12. So 12 becomes a number that talks about heavenly completion. The heavens show you the journey. Well, there are 12. So, back in the Old Testament scriptures now, Jacob is said to have 12 sons. Well, how many sons did Jacob have? I don't know. I know you don't know, and you won't find out by going to the Fisher Library, because we haven't got the information. 12 is fullness, got all the sons he needs to carry out God's will. And then we have etc. So here he's gathering 12. Why? This is a symbolic action. An action saying, this is the new Israel. This is the Israel of the Messiah. This is what Israel was always meant to be. So there are 12 symbolic of leadership. And when you read anything about 12 in the Gospels, you're reading about yourself. It's not 12 set aside and then there's the rest of us. 12 means discipleship. It's for us. And Jesus is giving us his authority and his love so that we will have the authority and the love to carry on his mission. These are the names of the 12 apostles put here, missionaries sent out. I'll read them even though you're very familiar with them, because I want to make a tiny point. This is the list. There's Simon, who's called Peter, and his brother Andrew. We've heard about them already in the Gospel. There's James, the son of Zebedee, and his brother John. We've heard about them. We haven't heard about any of the others prior to this, but I'll list them as he does. There's Philip and Bartholomew, Thomas and Matthew, James, the son of Alphaeus, and Thaddeus, Simon the Cananean, and Judas of Iscariot, who betrayed him. If you read that carefully, there's 12, and they come straight out of Mark's Gospel, identical. Interestingly, when Luke names the 12, they're pretty well the same, but he doesn't have Thaddeus in his 12, and he adds to this list Judas, the son of James. And Judas and James are such common names in Hebrew because James is Jacob and Judah is one of is the son of Jacob, the whole tribe of Judah. So they'll be, you'll find them all over the place. So there's a difference. It's not greatly significant, but it indicates a little bit of doubt in the church as to who the 12 were when you name them. And in fact, when you go to John's Gospel, the fourth Gospel, the Gospel of the Beloved Disciple, really, you find he doesn't list them. But he has a Nathanael in there quite early, as you remember. And he actually talks about Judas Iscariot, but also the other Judas, Judas, same one, who asks Jesus, you know, when are you going to, this is at the Last Supper he's mentioned. So who were the 12? I actually don't know, and I don't know that they knew, and I don't know that they have it, because it's not as if you've got a 12 barrier, the rest of the disciples. 12, there's probably different opinions as to who is, and they probably weren't sure themselves who are the key 12 people. In any case, the lists vary a little. We actually have Nathanael in our Feast of Nathanael, and people say Nathanael is really Bartholomew. Why? Where did they find out that? There's no information to give you that. So it's just a convenience to try and sort it all out. So there's the 12 in here. Be one of the 12, please. And this is what they're asked to do. Here we have the second mission, second list of sayings of the five lists, and now we'll read them. Go nowhere among the Gentiles. Enter no town of the Samaritans. Go rather to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. No doubt that's a very authentic remembering of Jesus saying, because it appears, it'll appear later, that was what Jesus himself thought his mission was. Because he says it to the woman of Syrophoenician. We won't do it now, we'll talk about it later. But it seems Jesus came not to do his will, but to do God's will. And he discerned in prayer that God wanted him, he didn't have long, remember, to mission to the Jews, to draw them, and then their mission will be to the whole world. And that's how Jesus seems to have understood his own mission at the beginning, until he met that Syrophoenician woman when he realised God was asking something more of him. So he's giving the same mission, his mission, to his apostles. Here's Romans 15. Christ has become a servant of the Jews, circumcised, on behalf of the truth of God. Why? In order that he might confirm the promises given to the patriarchs, and in order that the Gentiles might glorify God for God's mercy. And Paul says in a number of places, it's the Jews first, and the Gentiles second, because that's how it was historically. Jesus was a Jew, and you know all that. So there's his mission, and they have the same mission. Go, he says. proclaim the good news. And we know what that is. We've heard it already from John the Baptist and now and then from Jesus. The kingdom of heaven, God has come near. So that's our mission. So when you meet someone, however a stranger it might be, if you've got anything to share with them and they're open to share with you, what you're saying to them is, God is very near you, whoever you are. God has come near. Here's Isaiah. How beautiful upon the mountains are the feet of the messengers who announce peace, who bring good news, who announce salvation, who says to Zion, the kingdom of heaven, your God reigns. Love is reigning in the world. That's still our mission. And then he spells it out, Matthew, but look, you've seen it all before. Cure the sick. Well, that's what we've seen Jesus do. Raise the dead. That's what we've seen Jesus do. And by the way, raising the dead has nothing to do with emptying cemeteries. You got, what are we talking about? Raising the dead is, you know this from, it's in Luke, but allow me to remind you of it, about the prodigal son. The dad says to the elder brother, look, please come in. Your son was dead and now he's alive. Well, he wasn't in a cemetery, for God's sake, but his life was drained. He had nothing left. And look at him now. He's dancing and enjoying and having a beer or whatever, wine, I presume. But look, he's look at the community, sir. You go and raise the dead too. And you'll do that if you raise me and if I raise you. Cleanse the lepers. Embrace the sick, etc. Cast out daimons. Bring people a sense of meaning and a sense of calm and a sense of faith and hope and love so that they won't be... You receive without payment, says Jesus. Give without payment. Take no gold or silver or copper in your belts. You're not going to win people with money. Take no bag for your journey or your resources. Don't take two tunics. The one you got on's enough. And don't take sandals and don't take a staff. You're going to get support from God, not from a stick. Laborers deserve their food. If we took all that literally, of course, that would be stupid. It's not about literal. It's about an attitude. And to be sure of that, let's read what Mark has of the same passage. Jesus ordered them to take nothing for the journey. That's the same. Except a staff. So please don't think that Mark and Matthew would have been having a fight over who was right. Take no bread, because you're going to be nourished by something deeper than that. No bag, no money for your belt, that's the same. But wear sandals. Well, in Matthew it says don't take sandals and don't put on two tunics. So what are we dealing with? We're dealing with symbolism here. If you go to Mark... It's actually, I think it's a pity that Matthew changed it. But anyhow, when he says to have a staff and wear sandals, I think you can already guess what we're dealing with. We're talking about the Exodus. Go back to the story back in Egypt. And they had sandals for a quick getaway and a staff. That's all they took with them. Well, Mark is insisting you're on a mission. And you're on the mission that Moses had, and you're on the mission to take people through the desert to the promised land. And all those images, pick that up. Matthew, don't take sandals and don't take a staff. I'm not quite sure of this, but it makes sense to me. And we see it today even in the mosques. Not only in the mosques, but we do see it in the mosques where the staff and the sandals are left outside. And is that, that is an ancient habit, of course, among the Arab, but not only them. And probably back in the early church it would have been similar when they're coming into a holy place. It was the home originally, but anyhow, so they've taken... This means when you enter people's lives, I'm suggesting this is what Matthew's saying, when you enter people's lives, you're entering into a sacred place. So walk gently. Do what Moses did at the burning bush. Take off your sandals. Realise it's a very sacred thing you're involved in. Our mission isn't going out and bringing God to people. How stupid could that be, because God's already there. We're not there to tell people what to do, but we are there to encourage them to listen. Listen to their heart, listen to the Spirit, listen to God. And it's a very sacred encounter. And if we meet them, respecting their mystery, they might look in a mirror and start respecting their mystery too. Whatever town or village, the text goes on, you enter, find out who is worthy. Stay there until you leave. As you enter the house, greet it. And if the house is worthy, let your peace come upon it. But if it's not, then let your peace come back to you. If anyone won't welcome you, and if they won't listen to your words, well, don't spend forever badgering them. Shake the dust from your feet as you leave the house or the town. That was the Jewish practice when they went into Lebanon, wherever they went outside this holy land, so that they wouldn't bring in anything of the pagan world into this holy place. This is ideal, of course. They would shake the dust, even the dust. They didn't want anything to bring in to desecrate this Judah, this Israel. So here, the same image is used. Don't, if they reject you, well, don't wear it, but don't carry it with you either. Move on to where they're open to your message. Truly, I tell you, it'll be more tolerable for the land of Sodom, and Matthew adds, and Gomorrah, than for that town. And you know the story of Sodom and Gomorrah. I hope you know it's a story. Right in ancient times, way back before history, there must have been colossal seismic activity in what we know as the Jordan Valley, and then right down to the Dead Sea. In fact, it goes all the way down to Lake of Victoria in Africa. There's this, it's the largest fissure in the Earth's crust surface. So there must have been amazing activity going on there. And so it became, when people looked at it and saw the sulfur and it was well below sea level, so it's heavy with salt and so on. When they saw it, they said, do you know why that happened? And the kid says, no. And then they tell the story of Sodom and Gomorrah and don't behave like that, etc. So it becomes a, like Auschwitz or any other place, it carries a meaning because of the catechesis of the day. Well, Jesus continues it. I'm sending you out, says Jesus, like sheep into the midst of wolves. So you've got to be wise as serpents and innocent as doves. An amazing, beautiful statement for all of us. It's not going to be plain sailing, any of this, so you'll need all the wisdom you can have, and that was associated with serpents, and as innocent as doves. Let me unpack that for you a little. Innocent as doves. We've already read to be pure in heart. We've already read about not resisting evil with evil. Innocent as doves. There'll be evil there and you'll be treated evilly, but don't copy it. Don't retaliate in the same place. Loving our enemies. That's what to be innocent as dove requires, that. Being perfect as your Father is perfect. It's not a comparison. God's that perfect and you're going to be that perfect as well. It means the kind of perfection that you seek in your life is the kind of perfection you see in God. And Luke makes it totally clear, it's the perfection of mercy. That's what the perfection is. That's what the goal is. Keeping our heart fixed on God. We've heard all those already in the gospel. That's part of this innocent as doves. Here's Paul to the Philippians. We've just begun today reading Philippians in the liturgy. It's Romans first and then Philippians. Romans 16. I want you to be wise in what is good and guileless in what is evil. It's almost a direct quote of these words. Here's Philippians. Be blameless and innocent, children of God, without blemish, in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation. There was so much violence, slavery and in their world. And then we look at our world. So there's a lot to be done still. Wise as serpents. Let's have a little look at that. We have to learn to discern. We have to face and come to understand the realities of the human condition as they are, as they're manifested in ourselves and in those around us. Jesus recognized hypocrisy, so must we. We must know when we're being led to sin and know what to do about it. In other words, we've got to grow up. And some of us, I'll include myself, grew up pretty late. And then if you saw my life, you'd probably understand that. I came here to this beautiful place. It was a school. I came here when I was 12. And I learnt a lot. We lived like little monks. I don't regret it. But there's a lot I didn't learn, as you can work out. And then went to a seminary of men only for 7 years. Beautiful time. Wouldn't miss a day of it. Made friends for life. Spiritual friends as well, of course. All of that. And then taught in boys' school for 10 years. Don't say anything out loud, but can you guess the kind of things I didn't know? Well, so, and by the time I finished teaching school, I was 35. So you learn things at 15 that I learned at 30, or started to learn at 35. So we've all got to grow up, and we've got to give people a chance to grow up too. We've got to love them as they journey and be very sensitive to our limitations. We must know, etc. We're not to pass judgment on people, we've been told that by Jesus, but we must be discerning. And don't give what is holy to dogs. We've read that already. We're not to throw pearls before swine. We must be able to recognize false prophets. So wise as serpents, you could add to that list easily. That's what I came up with anyhow when I thought. So we have to acquire that. We've got to be real in a real world. But like Jesus, we're meant to stay loving in it. Not get caught in it and fight it on its own terms. Text goes on, beware of people. Now I think this scene probably indicates what had already happened within the community. Because by the time Matthew's Gospel is written, I think in Antioch, in the 70s, so there would be refugees there that have come up from the war between the Jews and the Romans, 66 to 73 AD, destruction of Jerusalem, etc. And they would have had a terrible time with Jews because the Jews wanted them to be caught up in this violent opposition to Rome. And they had, which was stupid, really, and got nowhere except the destruction of the city and all the rest of it. But the Christians were holding back from that. They were there for peace, not for war. And so they would have had a pretty hard time there. And they would have had a hard time with the Romans because they're caught in between it all. So there's many memories behind this passage. And they didn't just remember what had happened to them. That's not difficult. They also remembered that Jesus warned them that this would happen. What Jesus actually said, I don't know, but this is Matthew's effort to say, remember how Jesus warned us? I'll now read it. Beware of people, for they'll deliver you up to councils, that's Jewish councils, and their synagogues, and they'll scourge you. And you'll be also up before governors and kings. You'll be led for my sake as a testimony to them and to the Gentiles. When they hand you over, don't worry how or what you shall speak. It'll be given you at that hour when you'll say, what you say will be given you. For you're not the ones who are speaking. It's the Spirit of your Father who is speaking in you. And by this time they would have had many memories of heroic martyrs in their community and their friends' communities who remained beautiful while being tortured and killed, whatever else. The Spirit of your Father will speak. You will find the words. Brother will deliver brother to death. That certainly happens and happened then. Father will deliver his child to death because my child has become a follower of Jesus. I'm anti all that. And I say, no, no, you're not allowed to do that. And the child, the daughter or the son does it. Well, the father, and we've seen that, we see that in our world today, will treat them badly for it. Children will rise up against their parents and kill their parents. You'll be hated by all because of me, says Jesus. But if you endure to the end, you will be saved. Hold on to this precious, we'll see it in the next meditation. Hold on to this precious gift of faith. It might mean you death. It might break the family up. But this must come first. When they persecute you in one town, well, flee to the next. Truly, I tell you, you won't have gone through all the towns of Israel before the Son of Man comes. I don't have any confident understanding of that verse. You might, I don't. I'll give you the suggestions that I've picked up and that may, I think they have value, but I find that, what's this mean? You won't have gone through all the towns of Israel before the Son of Man comes. When's the Son of Man coming? In the lifetime of the people whom Jesus is speaking to. Okay, these are my suggestions. Maybe it's a referral, understood by Matthew and his community, as a referral to the resurrection, which is going to happen less than 3 years after Jesus' ministry begins. Maybe it's that. The Son of Man comes in this mysterious way, proving that love is conquering death, etc. Or Is it the destruction of Jerusalem, seen as a judgment coming from the Son of Man, which is always about judgment? And they've lived through that. Did they see then the whole point of it all? Or is it God's ultimate judgment of history thought of as imminent? And this is something that's going to play out through this gospel, in fact, through the whole of the New Testament, and we have to read it pretty carefully. It seems, not only seems, Paul thought the end of the world was coming in his lifetime. That's at the beginning anyhow, and you read the Thessalonian letters, it's there. It says, whether we're alive or dead, God will come, the right Christ will come. And I think Jesus thought that too. I'm not so sure of that because it's not explicit and we haven't got Jesus' actual writings, but I would think Jesus probably thought it was all going to happen fairly quickly too. That's just a suggestion. And actually, it makes sense because the resurrection, just go back then and be there and see the resurrection, see the risen Jesus. Well, if the resurrection is a beginning of a new life, a new harvest, a new heaven and a new earth, well, can you blame Paul, for example, for thinking the harvest has begun? Well, once the harvest begins, it's all going to happen pretty quickly. There's going to be time isn't irrelevant. So the first grapes are on the vine. Well, you better get the packers in to get ready to take all the grapes down for the vine harvest because it's happening. So the resurrection became a kind of a powerful moment that could easily have appeared in time, inverted commas, to be the whole new beginning. In fact, we know, and it becomes clear gradually, Paul seems to have become aware of it in his later letters, and you see it in other places, that time has nothing to do with this. So we're still waiting for the end, for the Lord to come. Come, Lord Jesus, etc. So but go back to the text. I'm sorry, that's vague, but that's as vague as I am. When they persecute you in one town, flee to the next. Truly I tell you, you will not have gone through all the towns of Israel, so it's not going to take too long, before the Son of Man comes. Maranatha, come. So it's not a time statement here. The disciple is more than the master. No disciple is more than the master. No servant is more than his Lord. It's enough for the disciple to be as his teacher and a servant as his Lord. If they have called the master of the house Beelzebul, and we've heard him do that, how much more the members of the household? If they accuse you, beautiful disciples, of acting from the power of the devil, they did it for me, so they're going to do it for you. So don't be afraid of them. There's nothing concealed that will not be revealed, and nothing hidden that will not be known. What I say to you in the dark, perhaps in the recesses where we go in for prayer, what I say to you in the dark, say it in the light. And what you hear in the ear, proclaim it from the housetops. Don't be afraid of those who can kill the body, but they can't kill the soul. If you're going to fear anyone, fear the one who's able to destroy both body and soul in Gehenna, hell. We've heard about hell. Well, who's that? Of course, it's God. God's holding us in existence. God's the only one who can take away the sustaining love and we go to whatever. So if you don't be afraid of all these people, Jesus says. If you're going to fear anyone, for God's sake, fear God. Thank God he didn't stop there, or we'd be in a bit of a mess. The next bit is beautiful. Of course, that's logical. If you're going to fear of the Lord, that's the only fear worth having. And then he goes on. Aren't two sparrows sold for a copper coin? I presume Jesus asked a kid that because it would have changed since he was a kid. And the kid said, yeah, that's how much you get today. No, one of them will not fall to the earth without your father. With you, even the hairs of your head are counted. So doting parents, I presume, the first little tooth that comes down, they say, oh, baby's teething, he's growing up, and the months are right, and he's whatever. So there's excitement in the telling your neighbours his teeth are coming. But no mother that I know of has ever counted the hairs on the head of the child. How doting you'd have to be to do that. Take you all day and take you a month probably. But so in other words, it's if you're going to be afraid of God. But God is upset when a sparrow falls to the ground. He's that soft. And you, even more, even the hairs of your head are counted. So don't be afraid. If you're going to be afraid of God. But what the hell are you doing being afraid of God for? So don't be afraid at all. You're worth more than many sparrows. Be confident that you're loved. Everyone who will confess me before people, I will confess before my Father in heaven. I know what you are. I know what you're doing, Jesus is saying. And I'll be talking to my Father, God, with joy about what you're doing. If you deny me before people, I'll deny you before my Father in heaven. Again, it's not a quid pro quo thing. It's Jesus will have to say to God, we've already heard it, I don't know them. They weren't loving for me or for you. He has to be truthful before his Father. This is the judgment of the eschatological judge who must declare things as they are. Jump ahead. I was hungry and you never gave me any food. That's the fact. Sadly. I was thirsty and you never gave me drink. I was in hospital, you know the rest of it. And you never visited me. Well, heaven, you can't be in communion with God. So Jesus has to admit the truth with tears in his eyes and love you for all eternity, but you're not able to enjoy it. Here's Paul's 2 Timothy again, his last letter. If we are faithless, yes, and we can be, he remains faithful. And then go back to the text. If you deny me, I know someone who denied Jesus, so do you, persistently. And it was Peter in the courtyard, denied him, and then kept denying him again. Well, maybe you could do it twice, but he kept denying him. That's three times means. That's Peter. But look, Peter still was embraced by Jesus and loved by Jesus and became the first, in our words, Pope. Leader of the community. So there's always hope. But if our life ends and we've never loved, well, that's tragic, of course. Don't think I've come to bring peace to the earth. I haven't come to bring peace. I've come to bring a sword. Peace meaning anything goes. Every opinion is good. Your opinion is as good as my opinion. Well, it may be better, but don't presume it. You better look for the truth. So that kind of peace just means nothing's happening. It's the peace of a classroom where the teacher is boring everyone to tears and they're all either nodding off or playing some game. They're not listening. There's no life. The peace that Jesus is wants to bring, of course he came to bring peace. We see that after the resurrection, it's so obvious. He breathes on them, etc. So peace is what he came to bring, but not that kind of peace. To stay with the image, and those of you who are a school teacher will know this, a peaceful classroom is one where every kid is totally engaged, interested, and listening and sharing. And it's wonderful. And the teacher goes out feeling great, and all the kids go home and tell their parents what they learnt, and they'll never forget it. That's a peaceful classroom, not a... So, and then he quotes, I've got the quote in a moment, so I'll read it to you, from Micah. I've come to set a man against his father. God doesn't want, Jesus doesn't want someone to be against his father, but he wants them to take up the message and the life and the discipleship. And if it means being against your father, I'm sorry, you have to be against your father. You're talking about what really matters here more than anything. I've come to set a daughter against her mother, a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. One's foes will be members of one's own household. Family values can be beautiful, they can be terrible, they can be give wings to a child, or they can clip their wings. We know that. And if family values aren't the final good thing, it's what Jesus is showing about God and about life. And that comes first. It would be beautiful if the whole family embraced it, but if it doesn't, Jesus is saying to his disciples, you must embrace it. It's about your life. We did it yesterday. Let the dead bury their dead. Here's Micah. Put no trust in a friend. Have no confidence in a loved one. Guard the doors of your mouth from her who lies in your embrace. For the son treats the father with contempt. The daughter rises up against her mother. The daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. Your enemies are members of your own household, says Micah, back in the days of Isaiah, of the collapse of the northern kingdom, and thank God Jerusalem survived it. So Jesus is using that image. He's saying, look, this is hard stuff. Do it. Whoever loves father and mother more than me is not worthy of me. There's a disciple loving that master, Jesus, and it must come first. Jesus isn't a pity. Jesus wanting everyone to love him and not love their parents. Well, you know that, but I mean, it could be badly read like that. No, you've got to love your father. And if you don't love your father and mother because you love me, you're not loving them very well. Whoever loves a son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. If you love your children, but you don't love God first, you don't love God in them, you don't watch in them for the divine, for the unique gift they have. When you're loving them, all right, and you're buying them Christmas presents and you're doing whatever else you do, but you're not actually loving them. If you really want to love your children, embrace them in faith, hope, and love. If you don't take up your cross and follow me, you're not worthy of me. And a statement that Jesus makes again and again and again in all the Gospels. If you find your life, élan vital, your life. If you find your life, you're going to lose it. If you find it, you're going to lose it. If you lose it, then you'll really find it. Lose it by giving it away. And we know this. If I become selfish completely and want everything for myself and hoard and whatever else I do, I'm not alive. But if I'm like my mother, thank God this would be something you could say of my mother and I hope of yours. If I'm like my mother and I just give everything away, well, it seems to be good. It seems to bring life. Or your grandmother or grandfather or the generous people you know in your life that just give. How beautiful it is. What they receive is stunning. Well, that's what this is all about. Don't go and try and find your own life by digging around. Give your life away and you'll find you'll live. Whoever welcomes you welcomes me. Whoever receives me receives the one who sent me. Brackets, my Father, God. Whoever welcomes a prophet because he's a prophet will receive a prophet's reward. Whoever receives a righteous person because he's righteous will receive the reward of the righteous. Just a comment. Prophets have a special mission. A prophet is someone, you know what prophets are in the Old Testament. It's got nothing to do with foretelling the future, by the way, in spite of the English word has taken on that meaning, but that's not what prophecy is about. Prophecy is speaking the truth in love. Now, so Isaiah spoke to his contemporaries for God out of prayer. He was a prophet. Jeremiah spoke to his contemporaries 200 and something years later, and he's a prophet. Well, a prophet in the church is someone who is in touch, picks something up in prayer and shares it. That's prophecy. It's a special mission. It seems that in Matthew's community, there were a group of prophets, could be anyone, man, woman, whoever in the assembly, who came up with the word, and everyone thought, my God, you're right. Could be a child, could be anyone. Could be an old person who has I just thought of a wedding I did a long time ago when I was chaplain at the uni, and I met a prophet, that's why I might as well finish sharing it with you. The wedding was going to take place here, and we were in Sydney, and there was a railway strike called on the Friday, just the day before the wedding. So we're in a kind of a panic situation. What are we going to do? So the wife to be was actually became a Catholic, but her father was a Methodist minister. So she rang his dad and he said, oh, you can use my church. So we did. And then we rang around other people and we got our beer. We kept that with the Christian brothers, I think. And then when we were in a parkland and everything. And we said the Mass and he was there too. And it was all a bit of a jumble, really. And everyone, and the choir was the Methodist choir. And who cares? They were a choir. So all this life was going on. And I'm thinking, oh, God, I hope I don't get hung, drawn and quartered for this. So at the end of the Mass, anyhow, I went out. And there was a man with, is it spina bifida? Like it was... completely, he was in an armchair. He was a Methodist, clearly, but I found out. But he was in this, and he called me over. And I went over to him, of course, and he struggled to say it, but he said, now, God, 30 years later, I'm getting emotional about it, but he said to me, I've prayed all my life that the Eucharist would not divide Christians. He said, today, my prayer was answered. Can you imagine how strong I felt? I thought, if the Cardinal calls me up, I've got four aces and Joker in my hand. Like that was just a beautiful, enough of that. So there must have been groups of prophets in the early church, of course, and there seems to have been a group called the righteous as well, like a beginning religious order, call it what you like. And they had a special mission as well. And Jesus wants the disciple to support these different people in the community. And we're reminded here of Paul's exhortation, "Let the elders who rule well be considered worthy of double honour, especially those who labour in preaching and teaching." Matthew 10:42. "Whoever gives even a cup of cold water to one of these little ones, because he or she is a disciple, I tell you truly, none of them will lose their reward." The same applies to the little ones in the community. Each disciple has a special mission, a unique gift of loving. Jesus appealing to his disciples to care for each other. And little ones doesn't mean children. It doesn't exclude children. But it means this humble, poor people, the simple people, the majority of people who don't have any extraordinary gift or mission, but they're there and they're loving and they've got a gift to give. And just to reinforce that, giving a cup of cold water, Jesus will come back in 25 when he talks about what ultimately matters in your life and my life. "Come, you that are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. I was hungry." This is Jesus speaking. "I was hungry and you gave me some food. I was thirsty and it was you who gave me something to drink. I was a stranger and you welcomed me. I was naked and you clothed me. I was sick and you took care of me. I was in prison and you visited me. Truly I tell you, just as you did it to one of the least of these members of my family." He's primarily looking at the community of Christians, the disciples, who have a mission to the world. It's for everyone, but he's primarily there. "You did it to me." When Jesus had finished instructing, so we've looked as best I can at the second group of sayings about mission now, first about disciples, now mission. When Jesus had finished instructing the 12 disciples, everyone in other words, the whole zodiac, he went out from there to teach and proclaim his message in their cities. Interestingly, he went out. According to Matthew, the mission of the disciples, we've been speaking about it, but it actually begins after the resurrection. Because only then do they have the spirit and the power and the grace and the energy to actually do it. So even though he's been talking about mission, it ends with the words, "He," Jesus, "went out from there to teach and proclaim his message to the cities."
The eye of the sun who did. Thank you.